too late to be able to change the course of events that you're now set on. Perhaps you're sat in an exam and you realise, you know, the examiner says, turn over your paper now, you've got 2 hours, and you turn over and you realise, I should have done more revision. I just should have done more revision, but there is now nothing I can do about it. Perhaps you, more seriously, you've got yourself in a relationship, a marriage even, where you've looked back and thought, well, it's too late. I can't change the course I've now set myself on. Perhaps if I could wind back time, if I could sort of travel backwards, well, perhaps then I'd go down a different route. But now it's too late. I've got no choice. I must carry on as I am now. It's an awful feeling, isn't it? The realization that actually choices you made, well, whether a week or a month ago, or even a year, 10 years, 20 years, have finally caught up with you, and there is nothing now you can do. It's a horrible feeling, and one that Paul, I think, wants the Philippians to avoid. Not so much in the short term, but in the long term. Several times in this letter, Paul refers to the day of the Lord, the day of Christ. The whole letter is written in the context of Paul knowing that one day these Philippians, who were just normal Christians like you and me, one day they will have to stand in front of God and give an account for how they've lived. And what Paul doesn't want is for the Philippians on that day to stand there thinking, ah, if only. If only. If only I'd listened to Paul back in the day. If only I'd taken his words a bit more seriously. If only I'd... Now, he's not worried they're not going to be saved. Okay, most of these Philippians, presumably receiving the letter, presumably they're Christians, they're going to heaven, so they're not going to get to the day of the Lord and think, I'm not going to heaven. Okay, these guys are Christians. But, Paul doesn't want them just to be, if I can put it like this, ordinary Christians. He doesn't want them to arrive at heaven by the skin of their teeth. In one of Paul's other letters to the Corinthians, actually, he talks about people being saved, but some just through the flames, as it were. It's almost like you get in by the skin of your teeth. And he doesn't want that for the Philippians. Back in chapter 1, he let us know that right from his first prayer. If you just look at chapter 1, he prays from verse 3 onwards, but we're going to pick it up from verse 9. This is my prayer, that your love may abound more and more with knowledge and discernment, so that, so here's the point, this is what he really wants from them, so that you may approve what is excellent and so be pure and blameless for the day of Christ. There's the day of Christ, it's judgment day. What does he want? Well, he wants them to be pure and blameless on that day. So he can't be talking there about, if you like, their justification, their status before God. Paul knows all their sins have been wiped away, put before behind God's back, that they're as far as the east is from the west and all the rest. Paul knows those verses as well as Philippians do, or you and I do. So he can't be talking there about, if you like, the Philippians' chance of getting into heaven. Because in that sense, the Philippians will be totally pure and blameless. Christ has clothed them in his righteousness. He must be talking about something else. What is it? Well, verse 9 and 10 give the clue. As our love increases, or your love rather, Paul says to the Philippians, with knowledge and discernment, so it becomes wise love, you might choose or approve the excellent. He's talking about their actual day-to-day behaviour. Your day-to-day behaviour, your holiness, to put it simply. That's what I want to be pure on the day you stand in front of Christ's judgment seat, says Paul. And when I said he doesn't want them to be average Christians, it's really playing off verse 10. I want you to prove what is excellent. At the time we said that in the Christian life we often think of, if you like, this is the line between sin on this side and holiness on this side. And as Christians we try and work out just to be one inch over the line. How little can I get away with living for Jesus, whereby I won't get told off for sinning, but it kind of won't cost too much? There's a guy called Don Carson who, I guess some of you might have read his books or heard him speak, and he talks about people wanting, I'd like half a pint of gospel, please, God. I'd want the full works, just enough to get me saved, but not enough so it's actually going to sort of mean anything to me, affect me. I'll have half a pint. You know, quarter of a gram of gospel, please. Whatever's just enough to push me over the line. Notice, Paul, what you want is what's excellent. I want you to choose not just okay choices, but brilliant choices. excellent, top-notch, if you like, choices for the gospel. So that's what he prays for them in chapter 1. It's what he models for them a few verses later in chapter 1 again, but verse 21. Really all the way through chapter 1, he's setting himself up as an example. And what do we see in verse 21? The famous verse, "For me to live is Christ, to die gain." If you want to make excellent choices, says Paul, that's got to be your attitude. Not I'll sort of do stuff for Jesus where I kind of absolutely must, or I'll do it 3 times a week, but where my whole attitude is, everything I do is for Christ. And then if I'm killed for it, even better. That's Paul's attitude. And that he clearly wants the Philippians to share. A few verses earlier in verse 18, he said that in every way, whether in pretense or truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. As long as Christ is being proclaimed and preached and honoured, I'm happy, says Paul. That's what he means by to live is Christ, to die is gain. As long as he is being honoured, I don't really care what happens to me. So he's prayed that they go for the excellence. He's modelled it, he's taught them what excellence would look like, what an excellent attitude would be. And he then goes on to give them, and this is what we looked at last week, he gives them motivation. The famous passage at the beginning of chapter 2. Particularly from verse 5 onwards, it's quite possibly a hymn. The example of Christ, Christ's humility. Christ, verse 5, who was in the form of God, he was in very nature God in some versions. But he didn't stay in heaven. He didn't count that equality with God that was his by right as something to keep hold of, but instead he humbled himself, came to earth, remained God, of course, but he came to earth as a man, not for his own benefit, but for your benefit, says Paul. He becomes a servant, verse 7. And not just a servant, he becomes a crucified servant in verse 8. He had every right to stay, and yet he came. That's been the build-up to the passage that Zoe read to us this afternoon. Paul praying for excellence, modelling it to them, to live as Christ, to die as gain. He's sort of exalted, rhapsodized, as it were, about what Christ has done. The very God come and humbled himself. And what do we get in verse 12? Therefore, okay, because of all this, without looking, what do you expect to come next? Now, Paul is in full flow here. So this is not sort of calm, measured Paul. He is, if he was preaching it, I think it'd be sort of bubbling all over the place, be bouncing across the front. He's full of excitement. What does he say? Well, therefore, beloved, therefore, Philippians, just as I've given up my life to become a missionary, I want you to do the same things. I want you to go to the ends of the earth. Stop being a baker or a plumber or a doctor or a candlestick maker. Sack it in and come and be missionaries. No. Well, at the very least, all become pastors, okay, ministers of churches, youth workers, UCCF workers, full-time ministry. If Christ has done that for you, and if you're going to make excellent choices, surely at the very least you could just give your whole life to being ministers of the gospel. There's a needy world out there. Millions need to hear it. And you know the gospel, so why don't you become ministers of it? No. What does he say? Verse 12. As you've always obeyed, in the past that is, so now, not only in my presence, but also much more my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. It's almost an anticlimax, or it could be an anticlimax if we misunderstand him. Jesus has done all this for you, so what I want you to do? Well, basically what his answer is just obey. Now, he uses this slightly unusual phrase, work out your salvation with fear and trembling, in verse 12. Work out your salvation sort of gets our sort of heresy bells jingling a little bit. Work out your salvation, isn't that a bit Catholic or something? You know, working your salvation. I thought salvation was a gift. Oh, well, it is. He doesn't say work at your salvation. He doesn't say work in order to get yourself saved. He talks about working out. The idea, if you like, is that salvation is something that God has given us, and then we put it into action. It's a gift, but it needs activating. The gift has consequences, if you like. What will it look like? Well, I think it basically is just obedience. When he says work out your salvation, he's sort of paralleling it with verse 12. As you've always obeyed in my presence and in my absence, effectively continue to obey. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling just means continue to obey. The idea, I think, is imagine a patient who needs a heart transplant. And he's, you know, goes to the theatre. It's life-saving surgery. He goes in there. He's under the anaesthetic. He wakes up and he's had a new heart put in him. And the surgeon says to him, "Right, you've got a new heart. It's functioning. Okay, it's not riddled with all the diseases that you sort of put into your old one. So now, work it out. Work with it. Use it. We haven't given you this new heart so you can just stay lying on the couch in hospital for the rest of your life until you eventually die. No, we've given you this new power, if you like, this new heart, in order that you can then put it into action. And as you work it out, well, so too, it will get fitter and your life, again, will be restored to what it should have been before your faulty heart knocked you out." Now, notice how God and man in verse 13 work together in verse 12 and 13, sorry. There's a command to us, to the Philippians, work out your salvation. But there's also the reassurance, verse 13, it is God who works in you, both to will and work his good pleasure. Salvation itself is just of God. You don't contribute anything to your salvation, do you? Not 1%. It's grace alone. But here, Paul's not talking about the process of getting saved, as I've said. He's talking about the process of getting holier in life. And that isn't God alone. If I can put it this way, it's not grace alone, actually. Unlike salvation, holiness is a process where God and man cooperate. The two together. God will not do all the work for you. It's possible for a Christian to be genuinely forgiven and actually make incredibly little progress in holiness because they just don't bother. Now, if they're genuinely Christian, they'll be in heaven on the last day. But they'll be in heaven on the last day, frankly, with a lot of questions to answer. When it comes to standing before Christ and being assessed and judged, well, what have you been playing at? I gave you that gift and you've done nothing. On the other hand, a Christian might receive the gift of salvation, have his new heart put in him by the Holy Spirit, and work his socks off to grow in holiness. They're both Christians, they've both got eternity in heaven, but they've both spent their lives in very different ways. Well, says Paul, I want you to be those who work hard, work out your holiness. If you've not made any progress in your holiness over the last, like, 5 years, if you stop to ask yourself why? Now, it could be that you actually have progressed. Sometimes, actually, when you become a Christian, you actually become so much more aware of your sinfulness that although in reality you're going forwards, you feel like you're going backwards. And actually what's going on is the Holy Spirit is showing you more and more sin in your life, so you think you're getting worse, whereas actually all that's happening is that what's always been there has been shown to you, and you've perhaps actually made progress. So it needs a bit of care, this. Perhaps talk to friends, those close to you. But it's also possible for Christians just to stagnate. And it may be that some of us here, that's what's happened to us. Because we're not pouring ourselves into growing in holiness, we're not pouring ourselves into developing, bringing to flower this gift of salvation. We've just received it, said, "Thanks a lot, God, this is great. Look forward to heaven, see you there. And now I've got my life to get on with." I says, "Paul, no, work it out. Excellent choices are what I want you to be making. To live is Christ, to die is gain, so work it out. And be encouraged, because ultimately it is God who is working in you behind the scenes." And that should keep you humble. If you have grown in holiness, there's no time for sort of patting yourself on the back and high fives all round. No, ultimately it's God. Ultimately he'll get the glory. Work, but work as one trusting God. If you like, that's still quite general. Having rhapsodized about Christ and the goal for our lives, that's still quite general. Work out yourself, just obey. So Paul gets a bit more specific in verse 14. Do all things without grumbling or questioning. All things without grumbling or questioning. It's quite dull, isn't it? If we're honest. It's not the most exciting command in the Bible. Having just told them that Christ has given up everything for them, all Paul can think of to say really is, so do everything without grumbling or complaining. And yet, it is what it says. It is what he says. Why? Well, certainly there is a particular context in Philippians. It seems that the Philippians, who are under pressure from the world around them, we've seen their opponents. I mean, Paul himself is in jail. It seems like the Philippians, as the pressure is put on them, are just beginning to fracture a bit in terms of their unity. He used the picture last week of just pressing on ice, and just a little crack begins to appear. And you know that if more and more pressure comes, then that crack's going to develop and widen and sort of crack off into another one, and suddenly the whole sheet might go. So Paul's a bit worried that the Philippians might just be beginning to fracture. And one of the things that will certainly fracture a church is if actually they're all grumbling at each other. Why is it me who brings the equipment every week? Phil doesn't do anything. Why me? Those pressures are always there in churches, and they're certainly there in Philippi. But actually, I think in a way that Paul wants the answer to the question, how can I, if I'm really a Christian who's living for Christ, who's pursuing excellence, how can I live my life? He wants the answer to be fairly prosaic. He wants it to be not spectacular, because for most of us, our life will not be one of full-time gospel ministry or mission. Most of us will be bakers and plumbers and teachers and computer engineers and shopkeepers and all the rest. So there must be a way of living life that really honours Christ, that is rewarded on the last day, where we can stand in front of the throne and Jesus says, well done, good and faithful servant, you've not wasted your time. There must be a way of that happening that actually involves me just staying as a plumber. And that's what Paul's trying to get at, I think, in this little passage. So doing everything without grumbling or questioning. It's not spectacular, but it is actually hard, isn't it? How often do you find yourself in a week grumbling? Either in a sort of church context or just at work, just normal life. I don't deserve this, you say to yourself. Or you gather around the coffee machine to have another little bitch about the boss who's unloaded some ridiculous project on you for the third time that month. Grumbling, it just comes out, doesn't it? Human nature just there, straight away, grumbling and complaining. The particular little phrase there is meant to remind the Philippians, I think, of the Old Testament and the story of the Exodus, where the Israelites have been rescued out of Egypt, through the 10 plagues, through the Red Sea. They get into the desert, they're on the way to the Promised Land, and what do they do? Well, after about 4 or 5 days, they start whinging. It's a bit hot in the desert, isn't it? I quite liked Egypt. We had cucumbers in Egypt. And they start grumbling. So quickly do they forget what life was like as a slave to Pharaoh. And so serious is their grumbling that actually, ultimately, many of them don't reach the Promised Land. Paul's just sort of bringing out those little echoes. Look, you've just been saved from hell. Be really blunt here. You were facing an eternity of torment. God could have quite rightly left you there. Just punished you. Just been just. Not been loving or merciful. He wasn't forced to come to earth for you. He could have just left you there. But he didn't. At immense personal cost, he came to earth, was humbled, humiliated, stripped naked, nailed to a cross, went through agony physically and spiritually, and all for you. And now you've got an eternity of paradise. It's a phenomenal gospel message. So really, in the context, what have you got to complain about? When you realise what God has done for you, the fact that, well, work's a bit tough, or it's nothing, says Paul. No grumbling. Do all things without grumbling or questioning, so that you may be blameless and innocent, just as he prayed at the beginning. In fact, the day of Christ is there again in verse 16. Hold fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain. This just normal holiness, just day-to-day holiness, will have consequences. It'll result in the vindication of Paul's ministry and presumably the Philippians' lives in verse 16 when the day of Christ comes. It'll involve witness, or result in witness rather, verse 15. As you live in the middle of a crooked and twisted generation, you'll shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life. That little phrase, holding fast to the word, is a word that can either mean holding fast to the word or holding out the word, offering it. And the picture is either that as the Philippians live ungrumbling, uncomplaining lives, it'll so stand out from the world around that people will be interested and sort of fascinated by why a group of people aren't complaining and whinging all the time. Or the idea is that they live holy lives whilst also evangelising. Either way, the idea is that the gospel is being commended, almost acted out, if you like, to society around. So just your normal holy life and a normal day-to-day job will result in glory to Christ in the world around you too. And thirdly, it'll result, well, it's just a, it'll just result in honouring God. Verse 17, funny little phrase again. Even if I'm to be poured out as a drink offering on the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you. What's Paul saying? The drink offering. A drink offering was an Old Testament sacrifice that went with the proper sacrifice. If you ever tried to read through the Old Testament and got to the books like Leviticus or Exodus, you know there's all sorts of sacrifices, bulls and goats and lambs and doves and pigeons, all sorts of things. And more or less, every time you sacrifice an animal, so you brought a bull to be sacrificed, you would also pour a drink offering on top of it. It'd be a cup of wine or something like that. A drink offering is a small offering that goes with a much larger one. In this context, the small offering is Paul, I am being poured out as a drink offering. What's the large sacrifice, the real offering to God? What's the Philippians? The sacrificial offering of your faith. And the context is sort of, I suppose, worship, ministry before God. What Paul is saying is actually, as you live your faithful lives out, that is like a kind of gift to God. And not all the sacrifices in the Old Testament were about atoning for sin. We're so used to the idea of Jesus being the Lamb of God who dies in our place that we assume all the Old Testament sacrifices are about some animal sort of having our sins confessed on it and then it dying so I don't have to. Actually, most of the sacrifices in the Old Testament were just gifts to God. They weren't about this atoning sacrifice. Many times, if you were an Israelite, a Jew, in the Old Testament, you would just bring something to God as a gift. Why? Well, because he's rescued you. Because he's offered you a new land. He's offered you a new family. He's forgiven you. And so you give him a gift. What Paul's trying to say here, I think, is that whilst those days are gone, okay, you know, we're not bringing goats on a Sunday to sort of butcher them at the front here and burn them to God. Actually, what you are giving, the way you give something to God, is by living a holy life that stands out from a crooked generation around you. And Paul says, if I can just be a little drink offering, if I can be the icing on top of that, well, then I've done my work and done it well, says Paul. So your holiness, your normal, boring, day-to-day holiness is actually, too, a gift to God. It does have significance. I think all this means, it means two things, really. First of all, it's a massive encouragement. If you consider your life pretty unexciting. Lots of us are in jobs we'd rather not be in. We can't see the significance of them. We don't think we're doing anything for Jesus. We don't think we're achieving anything for the kingdom. And we just feel, is this it? What am I going to have to offer on the last day? What am I going to be able to bring to Jesus where when he sits down and assesses my life, he's going to be pleased? I've not run any crusades. I've not spoken at a sort of Billy Graham rally. I've not travelled abroad to reach new territory for the gospel. Well, what can you bring? You can bring a life of not grumbling. And he will genuinely be pleased with that. And the fact that you've managed to stay patient with your kids most of the time, or not grumble about them, complain about them, that will genuinely really please him. It's not a small thing. In fact, that is the way that you will live out this to live is Christ or die is gain principle. Not spectacular, not glorious, no one will write a book about you, but Christ will be honoured and pleased. There are no commands in the New Testament, really, to people to give up their day job, stop being a baker or a plumber or a mother or whatever it might be, and get out there and be a proper worker. In fact, several times Paul says exactly the opposite. If you're a slave when you're called, stay as a slave. If you're married, stay married. Just get on with your normal life, but do it in a way that is properly sold out for the gospel. So these verses are a huge encouragement if I feel my life is nowhere near as spectacular or significant as I might want it to be. Normal, everyday holiness is hugely important. And I think, too, these verses are perhaps a warning to us. If we've begun to think that because I'm not doing front life ministry, it doesn't really matter how I live. Some people might even be hearing this and thinking, well, that's not very exciting. It's too easy. Can life really be about just not grumbling and complaining? About just living an obedient, normal Christian life? Surely that's just lowering the bar. Have you tried it? You tried living a life where you never mind a week without ever complaining. And not just sort of keeping your complaints internal, but sort of buzzing away inside, genuinely not complaining, genuinely seeking the good of others before yourself, as Paul talked about last week. It is incredibly hard work. Incredibly hard work, and will only happen if we're fueled by both the priorities that Paul has, live to Christ, to live is Christ, to die is gain, and the motivation, this gospel motivation. Before we start planning a sort of future where we're going to do something spectacular for God, one day I'm going to be ... a missionary, one day I'm going to be a youth worker, one day I'm going to be... What have we got on with day-to-day, boring, unspectacular, unnoticed holiness? I think that's why Paul gives the two examples of Timothy and Epaphroditus. It's one of those, I suppose, one of those passages in the Bible you sometimes get where it seems that Paul has just stopped his theology, parked his sort of spiritual stuff, and then just, oh, by the way, and put a few domestic arrangements in. It can't be that. Okay, we don't get Paul's shopping list preserved for us in the Bible or his letters home to mum. There's a reason things are preserved. And I think Timothy and Epaphroditus are examples of people who aren't apostles. So they're not up there in the sort of, I suppose, spectacular level of Paul and Peter, you know, the 12 who are going to rule on thrones in heaven and all the rest. They're just normal people, but who are willing to live extraordinary lives for the gospel. Timothy, again, verse 20, no one like him who will be genuinely concerned for their welfare, for they all seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. An ordinary, normal life of the gospel involves not seeking your own interests, but those of Christ. Epaphroditus, in verse 25, my fellow brother and fellow worker, fellow soldier. Epaphroditus is more or less just a messenger. He took the Philippians' gift to Paul, who was in jail, and Paul's now sending him back with news. Nothing particularly special about it. But he lives out the principle Paul's talked about. In verse 27, what do we hear? He was ill, near to death. Verse 30, he nearly died for the work of Christ. But what's his attitude? What worries Epaphroditus? Verse 26, he's been longing for you all and has been distressed because you heard that he was ill. Epaphroditus isn't worried that he's ill. He'll leave that to God. What he's worried about is the fact that the Philippians have heard he's ill and are probably worrying. See, again, he's not thinking me, he's thinking them. That's his main concern. And I think Paul holds up Timothy and Epaphroditus as people whose primary concern is to live for Christ and to die as gain, and therefore who serve the church. And Timothy went on to be a pastor. Epaphroditus, we don't know too much more about. But they modelled exactly what Paul had called them to. Putting other people's interests first. I don't know how you view your life, but one day you will have to stand in front of Christ and you will have to give account for it. One day Christ will ask the question, not just, have you believed in me? The in and out question. But also, what have you done? What have you done with your life? And he's not really going to care about your CV. He's not really going to mind how many Christian organizations you work for, how many meetings you turned up to. What he's going to care about is, did you live your life every day, hour by minute even, without grumbling, without complaining, working out, just obeying the holiest commands that God has given you? And if on that day you can say, yeah, not perfectly, but yes. Or more significantly, if he can look at your life and say, yes, you did. Imperfectly, bad days, bad weeks, bad months, bad years even, but yes, then actually that will be a sacrifice, a gift to him that will please him, bring glory to him, and bring you great joy that will just echo on into eternity. Small things, humble things, unexciting things, but eternally significant things. Let's pray.